From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. A veteran interior designer reflects on his life in decor.
I think everything's got a little too groovy and trendy, and I think you just need a decent chair or somewhere comfortable to sit and decent lighting and a view.
But first, if you hear the name Henry Huntington, you may think of that glorious estate in San Marino. But Huntington's imprint on Los Angeles was much bigger than that.
His impact is still with us today.
This is William Deverell. He's director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West.
In an era before the professionalization of urban planning, Mr. Huntington's imprint upon the vast expansion of the Los Angeles Basin made him, by default, probably the most important urban planner LA has ever had.
Henry Huntington made a fortune on railroads and real estate. Then, in 1919, he and his wife Arabella used that wealth to establish the Huntington Library, Art Museum, and Botanical Gardens, 12 miles from downtown Los Angeles. It was one of the first public cultural centers in Southern California. Well, now the Huntington is marking that institution's centennial with an exhibition about that turbulent year, 1919. We'll hear more about that exhibition in a moment. But first, let's hear more about Henry Huntington and how he shaped the LA we know today. Back to Bill Deverell.
By around 1910 or thereabouts, Huntington had monopolized, or very nearly so, the transit system here in Los Angeles, the trolleys. And by doing so, he was able to build trolleys out to empty land because he had vast resources of capital behind him. He's not interested particularly in the fares that he would get from passengers on those trolleys. He's interested in the upbuilding of the land and the rising value of the land by bringing transportation, hydroelectricity, water, other infrastructural things to that land. So he stretches the basin out by way of land speculation, and much of the early, before the Second World War, suburbanization of the basin is thanks to Huntington.
And he's involved with two mass transit lines, is that correct?
He is. He has the Los Angeles Railway, which is within the municipal limits of Los Angeles, and the Pacific Electric, the more famous of them, the red cars. And those are countywide. And so that vast traction network, that web of tracks, Huntington didn't build them all, but he monopolized them by way of his vast wealth.
And the vast wealth, we should say, comes in part from his uncle.
The vast wealth comes in part from his uncle, who's one of the big four, Collis Huntington, who builds the Central Pacific Railroad, the western end of the transcontinental. And Henry was his favorite nephew, and Henry was trained in the railroad business by Collis. Collis is phenomenally wealthy, and at his death at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, he cuts his fortune essentially in half. Half of that goes to his favorite nephew, and the other half goes to his widow and her son, Arabella and Archer Huntington. And then about a decade later, Henry and Arabella wed, and that pulls the fortune back into dynastic power. And she and Henry then collaborate through marriage and build this institution here of an art gallery, botanical gardens, and a remarkable collection of books.
And he starts the collection of books in New York and then decides to move it west.
Yes, it's a very startling decision. Henry, getting the advice of his advisors and his book dealers and those that he trusted, and also being terribly enamored of the potential of Southern California, Henry really does fall in love with this place. He falls in love with this ranch, and he falls in love with the promise of Los Angeles. And so he makes a very bold and very surprising move, which is to move the entirety of his library here in the early part of the 20th century, where, of course, now it still resides. And that's a stunning maneuver, to move things from the so-called centers of intellectual dialogue and libraries and cultural institutions to this outback place that has absolutely amazing ambition. And the establishment of the Huntington Library is proof of that ambition of the place.
Which is borne out. One thing that does shift, I guess, is the dependence on mass transit. His whole plan for the region is based on mass transit. And in his own lifetime, we start to see the rising popularity of the car. What does he think about that?
I'm not entirely certain what Henry himself thought about cars, although he had them. Arabella, his wife, is kind of car crazy, and she's very ambitious about the cars she owns and the cars that are driven for her very fast. I think Huntington, in a sense, is like the people of his time. So the 19-teens and the early 1920s, they think the car can be harmoniously absorbed into the landscape, into the transit structures, into daily life. And in fact, we've seen now, a century later, that that absorption is complicated and it's problematic. And so I don't think he quite saw that.
But here we are coming full circle. We're now rebuilding a mass transit system, some of which is pretty much following the lines of his.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Taking a look at old maps of the Pacific Electric Network, for instance, and recognizing the rights of way that Huntington established or purchased, so many of those rights of way are still viable in our transit system through Metro today. So even our freeway system, if we were to pick up our freeways and look underneath them, in many of our freeway networks, we'd find the skeletons of early traction, transit, and trolley networks that Mr. Huntington either built or owned.
Huntington, like one of, you know, America's other great benefactors, Carnegie, was a man of parts, I guess one would say. On the one hand, has, you know, left us this extraordinary legacy. And on the other hand, he's also criticized for having been a union buster, for having been very much a man of his, I guess, class and very opposed to class revolt. Is that true? Tell us about that side of him.
I think one of the most exciting things about marking the centennial is that a number of scholars, curators here and others, are trying very hard to decipher the inner life of this man. It's very difficult. He's an extraordinarily successful businessman who keeps a kind of distance between his inner feelings and any kind of public reaction to them. So he is not a fan of organized labor, there's no question. At the same time, Huntington is sort of steeped, largely through his uncle's tutelage, he's steeped in African-American philanthropy in the late 19th century. He's a supporter of Booker T. Washington and the Tuskegee Institute. He's interested in hiring African-American laborers. Now, in part, that's probably due to a fact that he thought that perhaps African-American laborers were more tractable and could be more controlled by the company. But at the same time, it adds a certain dimension to the legacy about a vision of racial egalitarianism or something close to that, that we have to at least factor in. The truth is, he is a man of many parts, and the parts are spread out wide across the collections and spread out wide across the historical memory, and we're still working on putting them together.
We are now marking essentially the end of the First World War, 1919. And what's extraordinary about that year, while people are suffering the devastating consequences of the war back in Europe, here in LA, there's very much a sense of looking forward.
So the early 20th century in 1919 is as good a year as any. Marks the arrival of remarkable institutions, lasting institutions, institutions with legacy here in Southern California. And in many respects, we're the inheritors of that vision.
That was historian Bill Deverill. And those institutions he referred to? Well, in 1919, LA also saw the arrival of Musso & Franks, UCLA, the LA Phil, and United Artists Studio. But not everything was so gung-ho for everybody. In fact, things were difficult for many who weren't in last century's 1%. And some of the challenges faced in 1919 are explored in a new exhibition opening this weekend at the Huntington called 1919. And the story's told through 275 objects drawn from the institution's vast storehouse of some 11 million items. The task of choosing those objects fell to two curators, James Glisson and Jennifer Watts.
As you may know, Huntington was really an amalgamator, a consolidator. He bought entire libraries and he bought entire collections. And in that way, he was able to, in a sense, corner the market in a very, very fast way. And by the time the institution was ready to announce itself, and Huntington was ready to announce it, it was considered one of the world's greatest private collections.
So, as you launch into putting together the show that is called 1919, do you start with a story and then go and look for the objects that will tell that story? Or do you look at the objects and out of that emerges the story, James?
You've guessed it. It's most exhibits work the first way. You know what you want to say and you find things that tell that story. This worked very differently. And we spent a long time, a good 18 months, digging and finding things and then assemble the story from the pieces that we found. The conceit or the restraint of the show for us was that everything had to be from the year 1919, edited in the year 1919, acquired in the year 1919, shown in the year 1919, or we're pretty sure it was. So it's a time slice through American history, but all of these things came to the Huntington. They've all come to the Huntington in the last century. The story we tell is a loose one, and Jenny had the brilliant idea of organizing it around verbs. So we've got fight, return, map, move, and build. And fight is the First World War. It's also the German Revolution. Believe it or not, we have an amazing collection of posters from the German Revolution of 1919. And it's also the place where we talk about the horrific racial violence of that year. Return is about the returning soldiers coming back to the United States, but also the way that after the war, modernist abstraction and, you know, cacophonous music and all of that went by the wayside to a degree. People wanted images that were familiar and safe. Map is much more about science and cartography, as you could imagine. We have the Mount Wilson papers and some beautiful images taken from telescopes on Mount Wilson in 1919. We have one of the most exciting finds. It was a 37-foot-long map of one of Huntington's streetcar lines. So it turns out that Huntington really made all his money. He's such a Californian. He made all his money in real estate development. And these maps are the subdivided lots along the line. They're beautifully rendered, so it's ink on silk, and as objects, just exquisite. And it's 37 feet of map. It was just staggering. Move is about planes and automobiles because it's right after the war that those shift from being kind of military things or very expensive items to things that everyday Americans can own or use or engage with. The final section is build, and that's where we talk about the Huntington. Early sketches and renderings of the library, pictures of the garden taken on glass slide negatives, picture of Huntington taken in 1919 that we learned was his favorite picture, as well as Arabella's favorite picture of him. And so in this final section, you get to see the very beginnings, the kind of seed of the institution that we would become.
As you went down memory lane, in a way, back to 1919, did you feel any resonance with 2019?
One object stands out. We have the records of the United States Marshal's Office. During the First World War, Germans were declared enemy aliens, and they had to report to the United States Marshal's Office on a weekly basis. It brought up for me and brings up a lot of parallels with current issues in the news regarding immigration, regarding xenophobia. All of that was alive and well in 1919.
And anything optimistic about the period that you feel is recaptured today, perhaps in exploration around transportation or something?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the Huntington is a very optimistic enterprise. And I felt that Huntington really decided to found his institution in 1919 with this idea of, okay, we don't know what the future holds. It's very uncertain. No one's clear about it. But we know that the arts and museums and science, the arts and sciences are so important to the human enterprise, are so important to the regeneration of the soul and to the regeneration of the spirit, that it's something that is foundational to who we are as human beings, and that this was something that Huntington very much believed in. And I think that that was very optimistic to realize that we are 100 years later, we are still talking about the Huntington and what he began, and we're looking to the future in a new and really more exciting way in many ways.
James?
I think Henry was such a visionary. What we call the pivot to Asia, he already saw a century ago in the development of the port at Long Beach. He saw Los Angeles as being a global city, which it is now. And then I like to think back to 1919 when we had the largest public transportation network on rails in the world. So maybe we can do that again and have a few less cars.
That was James Glisson and Jenny Watts, curators at the Huntington. Their exhibition, 1919, opens this Saturday. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, notes on decor from a very opinionated interior designer.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Interior designer Paul Fortune never really had a plan when it came to his career.
You know, I didn't have a plan, you know. I mean, and a lot of these kids have plans and they want to be a success and they want it now and they want to be at the top, you know. And I never had that. I just wanted to, like, take drugs and have sex and run around and have a good time.
But somehow everything fell into place and Fortune became the go-to designer for decades, along the way creating Les Deux Cafés and working alongside Marc Jacobs. Well, now Fortune has written a book. It's called Notes on Decor, etc. And it's the etc. part that matters, because the book is not your regular monograph or coffee table book, even though it has elements of both. Rather, it's a mix of memoir and opinion and how-to, all delivered with sardonic wit. Well, Paul Fortune dropped by the station and he riffed on the lessons drawn from his unplanned life.
There was a natural progression. So, you know, you get older, you're doing things. I came to Hollywood and there was nobody here. Like, you know, we were all just like flopping around in paradise and it was really cheap and really easy and really fun. And then the Brits came and MTV and video.
And you, Paul Fortune, were part of that.
Right.
You were part. So take us back. Paul Fortune grows up in the UK, doesn't really know where you're going in life,
right,
and you land in LA in the 70s.
Right. And I was a big Hollywood fan, so, and I didn't realize it at the time. It was kind of the end of Hollywood, but there was still, old Hollywood still around. Like, you could go to the Brown Derby, you could go to Chasen's, you could go to Scandia. I mean, it was still around. There was nothing here. There was nothing to eat. There was nowhere to go. It was just like the Roxy and the whiskey, and it was empty, but it was perfect.
It was empty, so what made it perfect?
It was just like a blank canvas, and it also had these incredible ingredients. Like, it was just basically a dumb cowboy town, except it had, you know, it had this amazing, you know, trajectory where it suddenly became like the center of the world because of Hollywood. People were still around. Fred Astaire and Rita Hayworth and Betty, all those people were around, and you kind of met them. You know, they were at dinner and, you know, you sort of met them.
Did you meet Ella Fitzgerald? You refer to her actually being at the dry cleaners?
I did. I met her at the dry cleaners. She was picking up her dress for some outfit, and there were no iPhones, so nobody was getting recorded or, you know, whatever. So people were just more open and it was easy. And I was a fan, but not an obnoxious fan. So it was easy to do. And that made it fun for me. And then eventually everybody else realized that it was an option.
Right. And a theme of your book is transition and change, and some of the aspects of 21st century life that you find somewhat off-putting, and they include social media.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. I get it. I mean, it's amusing, but I don't have the time for it. It's like another job, you know.
It is another job. But let's take you back to your sort of first jobs.
I do remember making these fake vegan animal skins.
Yeah, talk about the fake. I love the fake vegan animal skins.
Which was like 40 years before anybody else was doing. But I was into a cowboy thing, that's right. We went to Arizona and I was doing a cowboy thing. And then I couldn't really handle the real thing. So I made these fake skins that were cute. And then Susie Slazen, who was at the New York Times then, saw them and did a story about me. And you know, it kind of took off for a bit. I don't know. And then, I mean, it was just things like that came along, you know, and you just did them and then you did the next thing and the next thing. And then So I was, it just made me capable. I mean, I was just like, I could do things, you know.
Because you were doing a bit of production design, right. You were doing a bit of album cover design, we did actually the really well-known Eurythmics album cover.
Yes, which is a Polaroid.
The famous album cover that features Annie's face, slightly looking
gorgeous.
Off to the distance, gorgeous yeah. face. But yes, so you start attracting people in Hollywood, like, you know, an early client, I think, is Barbara Streisand, and off you go.
Oh, I don't think she was a client. We went to, I was making these lamps, and they were kind of silly cactus, and back in the cowboy motif, and I was making these fluorescent plexiglass cactuses that were lamps, and she was having a baby shower for a friend of hers, and I thought a really sharp, spiky thing would be great for the nursery. So we sort of she got one of those, and those were on the cover of the New York Times magazine. It was in 1978 or something.
So let's start talking about your opinions, because the book is chock full of them.
Really?
Chock full of opinions on what makes a decent space, whether it's lighting, whether it's use of fabrics, whether it's... So let's take up some of the themes that matter to you in decor, and let's start with A, as in authenticity.
You know, it's really hard to explain. It's the one thing I couldn't really come up with an answer. It's like you've got it or you haven't. Like, you know, it's an eye. You know, you have to... And people are like, well, what... I would have clients that are like, you know, I'd say, oh, well, I found this. This is this great fabric or this great rug. And they're like, well, I don't like it. And I'm like, well, it works really great. It's like going to be the best thing for you to do. Well, I don't like it. What about this one? I'm like, that sucks, you know. And they're like, well, what makes this one so good? I'm like, I don't know. It's just right. It's going to work. It's like this weird recipe thing. Like, I'm the only one that actually knows what it's going to look like or taste like, or maybe at the end of the project. Not the architect, not the client, not the subcontractors, not the vendor. It's me. It's in my head. But it's hard to actually explain the process to anybody because I don't know. It's just there.
Right. But still, even though you're the one that has it in your head, you're still trying to come up with something that expresses them. That's
right.
Authenticity.
Well, exactly. And it's good to have that kind of shorthand, you know, with somebody that you like, Mark Jacobs, who I've worked and done, and I'm doing a project with him now, which was a Frank Lloyd Wright house of all things in Rye in New York, which he fell in love with. And I'm not a big Frank Lloyd Wright fan necessarily, but it's a great challenge. And all my projects and all the things I've done, I mean, I don't have a look, and I've made it work. But I think anybody that does a house, like it does a project, does, even if it's the worst one ever made, it's like a miracle it gets done. You know, it's like a movie. It's like there's so many ingredients. The fact that it even gets finished is some sort of miracle.
And I want to get back to those miracles and some of the ingredients in a second. However, you did just throw down the gauntlet by saying you're not a big fan of Frank Lloyd Wright. Why not?
I'm not a big fan of most architects, actually. I think they're just fascists, you know.
they're over-controlled, the environment?
Super-controlled. I mean, which, of course, works up to a point, but then not when they want to do the rugs and the tea towels and the coffee mugs
and the
torture chairs.
One of the messages of the book is it's entirely intuitive, and so therefore one can't really tell people how to. But on the other hand, there are a few aspects of design that you are giving sort of essentially kind of guidance about, and one of those is lighting.
Oh, yeah, that's crucial. I mean, one of my horrors is all these, like, spotlights in the ceiling and stuff. And
why? Why? Well, what's wrong with spotlights in the ceiling?
Well, because if you stand under one, you look like Dracula, you know. And they have them in restaurants, and people go there to, like, you know, relax and have a good evening, and then you're sitting in front of somebody who looks like the Bride of Dracula. It's just one of those things that they kind of was foisted on everybody. It was like, oh, this is modern and groovy, and, you know, let's have, like, spotlights. And everybody fell for it, and it's a really bad idea.
So what would you advise?
You can have some very judiciously placed, you know.
Spotlights or other kinds of lights?
Spotlights, if they, you know, for art or something or whatever, but not like 5,000 in a row. Like, you know, just everything ends up looking like an operating theatre.
But tablecloths matter in restaurants because?
Well, I just think it's like a code thing. There's a comfort about it, you know, and it's not just a tablecloth. You have an undercloth and then you have a padding, so it things are softened within your immediate environment, and it also is a sound thing. And then the light from the tablecloth is an uplight to the people sitting there, so it's reflected off that, and people look good. It's an old trick; it's been going for years. So suddenly they want to just have these like horrible formica tabletops or wooden
or metal, and then of course the sound is just bouncing off of the metal.
Well, I literally have stopped going to restaurants. I can't do it anymore.
But it's too loud.
It's absurd. You know, might as well just be lying at the end of the runway at LAX. It's like it's so ridiculous, and apparently it's incredibly unhealthy. The decibel level is really stressful.
So let's talk about color.
Yeah.
I look through your projects. It's very little cold white.
I have a warm white. I've always used, like, I think it's a Dunn Edwards Navajo, and it's got like yellow and pink in it, and it looks white, but actually if you put white against it, it's practically brown.
And when you do use colour, which you do.
I do, yeah.
It's never primaries.
No.
And it's never fluorescence. It's never vivid. It's most definitely on the calmer end of the scale.
I like a strong orange or a strong pink I can use a strong colour. I just don't need dead flat primary color. I'm terrified of red and yellow and blue. I find them, they're too look at me, you know. I mean, I think when you go into rooms, you want to be relaxed, and I find it very weird when you go into these, you know, Miami houses, and they're all white, just full of like horrible fluorescent sculptures and things. I mean, literally, it's like a madhouse. I would go insane in like 10 minutes. And people live in these spaces. They think it's completely normal. I think it's detrimental to your mental health.
But the point that's interesting about it is, for you, design is very intimately tied up with social behaviour.
Right, absolutely.
It's not necessarily just staging a set.
No. Well, that's what it's become now. The whole design industry has just become this kind of like facade. You know, it's all about this facade, and people actually don't integrate with the facade. They're just always on the one side of it or the other. Like, it's a three-dimensional thing to live comfortably in a space, you know. And now it's all just about the right chair and the right crazy chandelier and the right whatever stuff. And I think these are all, you know, not necessary. I think everything's got a little too groovy and trendy, and I think you just need a decent chair or somewhere comfortable to sit and decent lighting and a view and whatever stuff. And it's not just decorating, it's movies and books and, you know, restaurants and cooking, and I mean, everything's in hyperdrive. Like, you know, everything's got to be super, super on and groovy and hot. And I just don't think that's really, that's not the way I see things. It's going to all change, whether we like it or not. It's all changing now. And I think that people just have to, if you can make yourself comfortable, make your own experience comfortable, make your own interior life correct, you know, it spreads, you know, and that's kind of one of the reasons I did the book.
Well, Paul Fortune, what a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
No, my pleasure.
Paul Fortune is the author of Notes on Decor, etc. And next Thursday, Paul Fortune will be in Los Angeles signing books at the Pacific Design Center, and he will be part of a panel about elevating our lives with design that will take place at Thomas Levin's showroom. See our website for details. You've been listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you to Avishai Artsy for producing and to Chuck P for mixing this episode. And if you like meeting people like Paul Fortune or, early in the program, Bill Deverell and the curators at the Huntington, you will find them on shows like DNA. And we are able to talk to them because of your support. We are now in the last week of our run drive. Now is the time to go to kcrw.com/join and become a new or a sustaining member. And if you need any more incentive, Donate now and you will be automatically entered into a sweepstake to win the all-new Apple iPhone 11. It was launched last week and it has, of course, lots more cool stuff. This special sweepstakes ends tonight at midnight, so join or renew your membership today. And thank you.